Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the men that I've admired greatly in this war of ours, this phase of the war for the free world, is Jim Simpson. He is a former official in the White House Office of Management and Budget, where he served as an economist and budget examiner. He is these days a freelance investigative journalist. I'm very proud to say he is the author of a monograph published by the Center for Security Policy Press entitled The Red-Green Axis, Refugees, Immigration, and the Agenda to Erase America. Well, that agenda is the focus of a new important report that Jim Simpson has just authored at the Capital Research Center, a terrific organization in Washington, D.C., which addresses the troubling question of resettling refugees and points out that it is an international agenda, one might say a globalist agenda, and very much, it would appear, one that has as its focus erasing America. Jim Simpson, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you, and thank you for giving us a full hour of your time to really drill down on this report and its important findings.
Hey, Frank. Great to be with you this morning. Thanks for asking me to come on.
Always a pleasure. So sort of set the stage for us, Jim. Refugee resettlement seems to be not simply innocuous, but a laudable activity, especially when you think about the large numbers of refugees fleeing for their lives or otherwise in need of refuge. What's wrong with this picture as you see it?
There's a lot of things. You know, refugees are fleeing conflict, civil wars, all kinds of different problems throughout the world, most of which need to be solved in those parts of the world. You know, repeated surveys have found virtually all refugees would much prefer to go back home because, of course, that's where they live, that's where they grew up, that's where the language and culture that they're familiar with is. And they want to stay there. They don't want to come to some new place and with all of its risks and uncertainties. But the refugee resettlement program has never, ever been concerned with that at all. Ever since the Refugee Act of 1980 was passed, the wholesale effort has been to redistribute refugees around the world, and I would add very critically, the Western world. You don't see refugees going to Russia, China, or anywhere else. They are specifically coming here. And in addition to the assimilation issues, the cultural problems, the language barriers, and the many things that they bring, they are heavily dependent on welfare for most of their lives. And this is statistics brought out by the Refugee Resettlement Program and pro-refugee organizations like the Migration Policy Institute. They all can't seem to get their heads around the fact that you take people who have lived one way in one culture their entire lives and just uproot them, transplant them to a totally different place, and then expect them to become masters of the new world. Of course, a few of them do, but most of them do not.
Jim, let me just ask you a question on this, because I'm sure that there would be a harsh response from critics of you and proponents of this project of refugee resettlement. When you say most of them are coming here, the numbers are relatively small, certainly when compared with those that are now washing up in Lebanon or Jordan or other parts of the Middle East, to say nothing of what's come to pass in recent years in Europe. But I think your point is many of these refugees are being resettled in the Western world writ large, of which, of course, the United States is an important part. But Jim, to come to something that you touched on that I think really requires us to tease it out, who are these refugees by and large? You've indicated that they may not assimilate very well in the West. Why is that?
It essentially requires them to reorient their entire life, their abilities, their language. Most of these people come from very backward countries. And of course, you know, when you have an immigration program like the one that we do, people who want to come here, people who want to better their lives, are those people who are self-motivated, are those people who would be, if they could, be business leaders or political leaders in their own country, but because of the circumstances, the government or whatever exists in their own country, they can't do it. So we see the people who are good at assimilating, who want to become Americans, who want to enjoy and prosper in the life that America and the Western world generally, but America mostly, can uniquely provide. Those people assimilate just fine. And they do, you know, they get jobs, they go to school, they learn the language, and they assimilate and they become Americans. And, you know, you can talk to, I like to talk to taxi drivers that come here, people who have, found their way here and worked their way into our society. And, you know, they all talk it up. But when you get entire communities uprooted and moved and then spread haphazardly around the various nations of the West, it's a whole different story.
It's a particularly different story if they don't want to assimilate. You know, if they come here with the view that their societies, their culture, you didn't mention their religious traditions, notably those that are, I think, best described as Sharia supremacist in character, are the kinds of things that discourage assimilation, if not actually make it very onerous indeed on those refugees, if they're tempted to associate with or make friends with the kufirs, as they're called, the infidels. This is generally frowned upon by the Sharia supremacist types. Jim, we have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, though, I want to drill down a bit more on this, because to the extent that the globalists, if you will, the advocates for this refugee resettlement program, think it's not a problem to bring large numbers of people, whether it's into this country or Europe or elsewhere in the West, even if they refuse to assimilate. This is something that does require careful scrutiny. It defies common sense, of course. But your evidence, including that you have marshaled in the Red-Green Axis and more recently in Resettling Refugees, an International Agenda, a report of the Capital Research Center, is really required reading. We'll talk with the author, Jim Simpson, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Jim Simpson for this full hour of Secure Freedom Radio. Jim is an intrepid and quite accomplished investigative journalist. He is a former OMB, Office of Management and Budget official, and the author of not only the Red-Green Axis, Refugees, Immigration, and the Agenda to Erase America, but a report that very nicely complements and updates that book, Resettling Refugees, an International Agenda, just released by the Capital Research Center. And Jim, we were talking about this phenomenon of Sharia supremacism, and one of the impetuses behind the migration, as you say, of large numbers of people who are themselves of that ilk, or at least come from that faith tradition. It's not just so much a faith tradition as it's a kind of political environment. Not moving to Saudi Arabia, not moving to elsewhere in the Gulf as a general rule, but moving into Western societies from the Middle East, from Africa, from Central Asia, and so on, is in furtherance of a duty that many believe they have under Sharia for migration, that is to say, the hijra, to spread the faith. To what extent does your research suggest that's operating in the movement of essentially unassimilable populations from these regions to the West?
Well, here's my take on it. You know, Muslims from the Middle East began trickling into the United States in the 1800s, in the late 1800s.
Notably, I understand Henry Ford thought that they were a perfect workforce because they would work on Sundays, as I recall.
I was just going to say that was greatly boosted when Henry Ford decided, and literally he said this, that he thought hiring Arabs would work harder than the blacks in the Detroit area. And he began encouraging immigration from those nations to populate his factories. And as a consequence, Michigan, especially the Detroit area, Dearborn and so forth, became a target for Muslim immigration, or Arab, both Christian and Muslim, actually, immigration into that area. And, you know, here's the way I see it. Those people started coming because they saw an opportunity and because the door was open to them. But along with them came others who had a different agenda in mind. And we know that, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood established itself in the United States in the 1960s. Now, of course, the Arabs in Michigan had been here since the 1920s, and they had built mosques, and they had populated the community to a great extent.
Notably, places like Dearborn and Detroit.
Yeah, and a lot of those people, you know, did assimilate in a certain sense. You know, they became, they were gainfully employed, and they didn't cause problems in their community. But there's always the issue of the people at the top who are looking to capitalize on these things. And to some extent, the people that originally moved here may have been motivated by the notion of hijra, but I think a lot of those people were frankly trying to escape that thing.
But not the Muslim Brotherhood, that's for sure. These guys are Sharia supremacists through and through.
No, that's absolutely right, yes. And so the problem becomes that, so you have a big community of Muslims who are perfectly happy to be here, perfectly happy to, you know, pay lip service to Allah. But then along comes this very calculating, very malevolent group that knows that they can coerce these people into working their agenda on their behalf. And so they do that.
And they do that by essentially espousing and trying to enforce the dictates of Sharia, which say all faithful Muslims must submit to this sort of jihadist supremacist program to dominate the world. And I think this is what we've seen over time, especially as these refugee populations have been added into the mix, Jim Simpson, in recent years, some portion of whom, as you say, are all about assimilating, but many of whom don't have a clue as to how to do it, even if they wanted to, and who are under pressure not to. In fact, one of the things, Jim, I think it's important to just say, we've over the years, you and I and many others over the years have expressed concern about a woman by the name of Huma Abedin, who wound up being at the right hand of Hillary Clinton for decades in her various roles. But one of the things that's not generally understood, you know, we've been talking amongst ourselves and wherever else possible, about her ties, Huma Abedin's and her family's, to the Muslim Brotherhood and its supremacist agenda. But little known by most people is the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood put her family in the business of promoting non-assimilation by Muslims in what were then called Muslim minority nations, that is to say, the West, including this country. Right. And so it's a fascinating sort of prism through which to study how the Brotherhood operates and the fact that they're using Sharia to dominate these refugees especially and to bend them, even the ones who have assimilated where possible, to their their program.
Yeah, well, it really is a divide and conquer kind of strategy, because what they do is they take those communities and put them at implacable contrast or implacable opposition to the host country's culture, traditions, and laws, which, of course, provokes a reaction. And that reaction is, we don't like this. And then, of course, because it was a provocation in the first place, they're saying, oh, look, see, Islamophobia, they hate you. And then those people become defensive and they get their back up. And the whole goal is to divide. The whole goal is to divide and conquer. And it's exactly what the left does with, for example, gay rights and minority rights and all of the other various group rights that they advocate for constantly. The real goal is to set us all against each other, divide and conquer.
And Jim, you just introduced a very important subtext of this plot, and that is the role played by the left in promoting this refugee resettlement business and more generally in furthering, through what you, among others, have called the red-green axis, this agenda of Sharia supremacism. And I'd like you to spend a minute talking about that, Jim, because, on the face of it, it seems bizarre, not to say completely improbable, because after all, the people who would be put to the knife first by these Sharia supremacists are, major totems of the left, the feminists, the homosexuals, the Jews, apostates, the like.
Oh, no, absolutely. But, as I have, I always initiate my presentations with, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. The hard left, the people who are leading the charge here, could care less about homosexuals or minority rights or any other right. They are using those groups as a wedge to divide our country and to, at the same time, insinuate themselves into positions of power, which, of course, programs like refugee resettlement enable immensely. And in fact, I dig very deep into that whole aspect of it in this piece. The refugee resettlement program puts out billions of dollars, and the organizations that receive that money are, to a man, left-wing organizations, all committed to the open borders agenda. And so it becomes both self-serving for them to promote and support, defend and grow this, what has become an industry, while at the same time, they are bringing in groups of people that will not assimilate, that will build their political power, that will vote for them. Refugees become citizens after 5 years and will vote for them and expand their power base. And I mean, that's really what they're about, and that's all they're about. It's all they've ever been about.
In that regard, it kind of falls into the larger sort of open borders agenda of the hard left, doesn't it? To bring in these populations, change the demography, change the voting patterns of the American polity for the purpose of, as Barack Obama famously called it, Jim, fundamentally transforming America. And, you know, I want to just tease this out with you a little bit more, and we'll have to do some of it on the other side of the break. But to the extent that these unassimilable, predominantly Muslim refugee populations are making their way into this country and are taking up citizenship, or I suppose in places like California in particular, voting even when they're non-citizens, the effect is predictable, is it not? That we will see increasingly the sort of permanent majority of people who do not have an attachment to the United States, but who are nonetheless voting for a party that is perfectly prepared, as you say, to advance the revolution. Jim, we have to pause. We'll be right back with much more with Jim Simpson after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting with a friend and colleague, Jim Simpson, the occasion of the publication of a very thought-provoking, very troubling essay by him published by the Capital Research Center. Jim is, of course, a man who knows his way around government. He oversaw budgets in the Office of Management and Budget. He has been a freelance investigative journalist now for some years, and the author, among other things, of a wonderful book by the Center for Security Policy Press, I'm proud to say, The Red-Green Axis, Refugees, Immigration, and the Agenda to Erase America. And Jim, I want to talk a little bit about the mechanics of how that agenda is being advanced. Let's start with just the basic infrastructure for bringing refugees into the United States. Who decides who are refugees, for one thing?
Well, you start with the UN refugee camps administered by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Now, almost all refugees wind up in a UNHCR refugee camp, and the UN High Commissioner accepts applications and selects about 95% of the refugees that are ultimately brought to the United States. So the UNHCR initiates that, and then there's overseas refugee centers which review those and send them to the State Department, which ultimately picks among the list that's been brought to them
by the United Nations. Let me just interrupt you for a second, Jim, because just a point of clarification. As I understand it, most refugees may wind up initially in these UN-administered refugee camps. But, for example, if they're Christians, it turns out it's a very dangerous place to be. And so if they don't avoid going there in the first place, they don't stay there very long because it's hazardous to their health, shall we say. So that would mean, if true, that the population that the UN is selecting from in these refugee camps is overwhelmingly Muslim in character.
About 98%, yes.
So when that list is provided to our State Department personnel from which to choose some number, and the number changes by virtue of what the president says we're going to admit, I guess, year after year, But Jim Simpson, isn't it the case that as a result of the way this thing is structured, what we wind up admitting as refugees is almost exclusively Muslim folks from the Middle East, Africa, or elsewhere?
Well, it has been in the aughts.
The first decade of the 21st century.
21st century and into the second because of the Syrian issue. And, you know, the Syrian crisis. But when I said 98%, I meant 98% of those resettled from UNHCR camps where they're almost entirely Syrians. But that migration, that mass exodus from Syria also inspired a mass migration out of Africa and all over the Middle East. And really, many of those people weren't fleeing war. They were seeking, they saw this as an opportunity. And so only about 20 or 25% of the refugees, for example, and I use that term very loosely, flooding into Europe, are actually Syrians. They're from all over Africa. They're from all over the Middle East. And yes, primarily Muslims, but not merely, but not entirely Muslims. But those people are not people from refugee camps. Those people who are people who just picked up on their own. And I can't believe that that was something that just happened coincidentally, that suddenly all these people saw this opportunity. They were told, somebody told them, said, listen, this is your chance. Take it now. And as we know, the ISIS, for example, runs many of the smuggling routes for these people, these migrants coming up from the Middle East and from Africa into Europe.
Yeah. And Jim, when you say an opportunity, again, I think it's just important to understand the meaning of that. It's not simply an opportunity to better themselves economically by finding jobs and work opportunities that would enable them to better themselves. So just talk us through that, because this is an important part of the mechanism by which these people are incentivized to come to the West.
Well, no, I mean, look at Germany, for example. Very few of the migrants that have come up with this most recent flow are working or even looking for work. They see it as an opportunity to come to a country and live off the dole. And that's what they're doing.
The welfare, yeah. And the more generous the welfare system of the countries, the more attractive they are to them, whether it's Germany or Sweden or some of the other Northern European nations. And Jim, when you talk about this, it really begins to come into focus that these are people who are imbued with a sense of entitlement to live off of others' hard work. This is, again, in not every case, but in many, a function of this sort of Sharia supremacist notion that Muslims are superior and everyone else must serve them and pay the jizya and otherwise enable their domination. Jim, I did want to come back to the other piece of the mechanism. Once the State Department comes up with the list, what happens to these refugees that gets those that are coming to the United States here and settled?
Okay. Well, I'll give you a quick run through. So the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, is responsible for vetting refugees. And until Trump came along, they really weren't vetted. They were just processed. And that's according to the USCIS itself. I'm not making that up. But the refugees, the State Department selects them, and then it turns that list over to 9 tax-exempt government contractors that are improbably called voluntary agencies. There's nothing voluntary about them, but that's what they've been called, VOLAGs for short. And there's 9 of them, 6 of which are nominally religious, for example, Church World Service, the Domestic and Foreign Missionary Society of the Protestant Episcopal Church.
Catholic bishops.
U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, and World Relief Corporation and the National Association of Evangelicals. 6 of the 9 have religious connotations, but none of them are religious. They are not allowed to proselyze. They often talk about the great mission that they're on, but they aren't on any mission other than to resettle refugees, and they're not allowed to proselyze in any way, shape, or form to refugees.
If anything, what they are helping facilitate is the migration of people who have a tradition in Sharia deeply hostile to their own faith traditions, and they've become these champions for the migration. But explain what I mean, you touched on it sort of with that point about them not really being voluntary, but what is the cash benefit to these faith and other Volags to participate in this refugee resettlement program?
So they're paid by the head to resettle refugees. The State Department gives each Volag $2,125 per head to resettle refugees, of which the Volag gets to keep about 45% for itself. The rest is used to find a place for the refugee to live and to provide a laundry list of services, including housing, furnishings, food, clothing, pocket money, assistance applying for public benefits, assistance with health screenings, registering children in school, transportation to job interviews, job training, and home visits. You know, this long laundry list. So they get that initial money, and then the Health and Human Services Department Office of Refugee Resettlement provides grants for all kinds of refugee programs and services. For example, they have a matching grant of $2,000 for $2 for each dollar that the Volag raises for refugees to try to help them get jobs. Now, the interesting thing about that is that the Volag can provide that $1, 80% of that $1 in kind. And so what they do is they go to churches and get churches to donate furniture, to donate time, to donate money, and they wind up paying very little. So, for example, to get a $2,000 grant from the from the Office of Refugee Resettlement, they could put up as little as $200. And sometimes they don't even put up any money at all. For example, Church World Service put out a notice for volunteers. Now, the volunteers were required to provide $1,000 to provide all of these other goods and services, and then to go around and do all of the tasks that the Volags are being paid to do. So the Volags can actually make money from their volunteers.
Jim Simpson is our guest. We're going to take a quick pause, and we'll be right back with our final installment of this very important conversation about the refugee resettlement business, the international agenda, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for the concluding installment of a really fascinating and very troubling interview with Jim Simpson, a freelance investigative journalist, the author of The Red-Green Axis, Refugees, Immigration, and the Agenda to Erase America, and a new report by the Capital Research Center entitled Resettling Refugees, an International Agenda. And Jim, one of the things that I've taken some heart from is Donald Trump, who basically ran on a platform of getting a grip on immigration policy, vetting Sharia supremacists and other jihadists so that we weren't admitting more of them, and tightening up our borders, building a wall, and so on. He has, in fact, dramatically reduced, we're told, the numbers of refugees being resettled in the United States. Give a sense of what has been done in that regard, and whether that's the full story that we should have our eye on as well.
Right. Well, as everybody knows, the left in this country, everywhere from Obama-appointed judges and other left-wing judges, organizations, they have put an enormous pushback against his immigration agenda. The one area that they can't control is his ability, A, to vet refugees, and B, the cap on the annual number of refugees allowed in the country. So for 2018, he set the cap at 45,000 refugees, and because he has imposed extreme vetting, which is really the first time in a long time that any kind of vetting has ever been done, he's created a bottleneck. And so the refugee program has brought in only 21,500 this fiscal year. And that's the lowest number in its history since 1980. The trouble is that there are a lot of other programs that don't have those caps, and he doesn't have as good control over the special immigrant visa program, which brings in Iraqi and Afghan people who allegedly assisted us during the war, although there's a lot of fraud in that program, 13,000 this year. There's the Cuban-Haitian entrant program. Numbers aren't available for that, but typically it's about 20,000 a year. And asylum, huge numbers of people are taking advantage of asylum because the refugee entrance has been blocked. So, for example, in 2016, there were 25,000 asylees allowed into the country. 2018, there's 28,000 approximately coming in. There's also trafficking victims and the unaccompanied alien children program, which remains at Obama-era levels. This year, about 37,000 unaccompanied minors are going to come in the country. And they don't mention the families, but the families, you know, the unaccompanied alien children were never unaccompanied. They were accompanied by their family members or other family members who brought them into this country. And those people are resettling here as illegal aliens as well. And that's probably about 50,000 a year. There's so many people coming in and so many angles that despite his clampdown on refugees, where he really was the only place he has absolute control, there's still over 100,000 coming in this year. It's a lot lower than it has been in recent years, but it's really historically not that low at all.
Jim, let me ask you about one other piece of this, because the people who administer this program, the refugee resettlement program, are skilled at trying to work around the president's direction. It's a sort of classic example of the counterstate, I think is more accurately the way to describe it. Much in evidence these days as a result of James O'Keefe's terrific series of videos about some of the people who've burrowed in. But tell us a little bit about who these people are. And it, obviously, this is some generalizations. But my understanding is that a fair number of them kind of revolve through from the VOLAGs into government and back into the voluntary agencies and then back into the government and so on. So it's a kind of incestuous arrangement that essentially perpetuates this process ad infinitum. Is that right?
Absolutely. And there's a really good, well, there's numerous examples of that, but we don't have time to go through all of them. But for example, the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, one of the big VOLAGs, was led by Lavinia Limon for many years. Before she worked at the USCRI. She worked as the director of the Office of Refugee Resettlement during the Clinton administration from 1993 to 2000. Now, she departed under very questionable circumstances October of 2017, and the VOLAG claimed that she was retiring. But almost immediately, she resurfaced to lead another organization called the Immigration Refugee Service of America. Now, this is really bizarre because there is no listing of this organization among nonprofits. it was listed as a VOLAG by the State Department, ironically, as of April Fool's Day 2001, but it hasn't existed since then. It has a phone number and an address, but I've called that phone number numerous times, and it's a constant busy signal. I haven't had a chance yet to go to the address, but I intend to do so. It's very strange what's happening. Her position was taken over by a guy named Iskender Nigash, who himself was a refugee, and the refugee contractors very frequently hire former refugees because, once again, it provides a bigger incentive for refugees, right? Keeps them in the program.
Turns them into sympathetic advocates, too, needless to say. Well, Jim, let me just ask you, if I can, one of the things that I think is a byproduct of much of this is really, well, to put a fine point on it, the corruption of the faith community, many of whom are, to be sure, motivated by humanitarian concerns and, you know, a sense of biblical duty. But it's a very selective reading, it turns out. Our friend and colleague Kelly Kohlberg has made this point that, you know, a whole of scripture approach makes it clear that open borders is not biblically ordained by any means. But talk a little bit, Jim, about what's happening as parts of the faith community seem to be divided by those pursuing this agenda, presumably for the purposes, as you said earlier, of dividing the country more generally.
Well, yeah. And you know, here's the problem. The left has attacked our religious institutions for 100 years. They began infiltrating the church. The communists began infiltrating the church in the 1930s. Their goal was to destroy the church because they know that the church is the basis for Western culture, Western tradition, and most importantly, the strength and backbone of this country. And they're trying to destroy that. So as a result, Christianity, for example, has been dumbed down. So many people who think they're Christians really don't understand what Christianity is. And as a result, it's very easy for them to be manipulated into a false works mission that tells them this is how they reach salvation, by giving until it hurts to an organization that is intent on destroying them. And the interfaith dialogue is the key front and center element of that agenda. And it is a very malevolent agenda because, as you know, it doesn't raise and glorify Christianity or Judaism. It is used to insinuate the notion that Islam is a religion that Christians and Jews should respect and regard as not merely equal to their own, but better than their own.
Yeah. Jim Simpson, we have to leave it at that, I'm sorry to say. There's so much more to talk about. We'll look forward to talking with you again in the near future. Come back to us soon. Hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.